Podcast. I am your host, The Organic Guy. This is your home of organic conversations, where you get to hear from various thought leaders across the organic movement. Today, I am super stoked to welcome Mr. Donald, who is the CEO of BioGrow, which is New Zealand's leading organic certifier. For 26 years, Mr. Donald spent his time in Japan, where he was importing and exporting organic products. He's also a prolific author, where his latest book, Organic to the Core, is out now, where he lays out 6 organic principles that you can use to transform your business. So without further ado, Mr. Donald, thank you very much for joining me on the podcast.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really excited to talk to you.
Yeah, I mean, your story is really, really interesting because you are actually born in the United States, and then you found yourself in Japan, and now you are in New Zealand. So did you picture yourself getting into the organic space at all?
Well, when I was growing up, I grew up in a really small town in Wisconsin, and I was surrounded by cornfields. So basically our house was surrounded by cornfields. Yeah. So I grew up in the countryside, but I wasn't working on a farm. And so organic, no, I don't think the farms were organic. But one funny fact is that my uncle had a massive garden and basically fed the whole family in the summer. Wisconsin, the summer is very short, so we didn't get much chance to eat out of the garden. But I learned later that he was practicing organic principles, and he had organic magazine from Rodale, and I got his subscription later on after he passed away. And that was the first time I realized that everything we'd been eating was organic all that time.
It's quite interesting because I even remember myself when I was growing up, I really didn't know what organic was. I just realized later on that all these things my grandmother was doing were actually organic. Some of these things that we go through in life earlier on, we never really know them until later when you're looking back and you see, you know what, this kind of makes sense. And this was organic from that time, from that perspective. So it's really, really interesting when you look back and see where you've come from. Everything seems to connect in one way or another.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know how I find myself in New Zealand. It's quite a long and winding road, as you can imagine. Growing up, I grew up I graduated from high school in the 80s. So that was a long time ago. And when I was a boy, I never imagined even going overseas, right? So I studied French in junior high school and high school. And I think the closest I ever thought I'd get was Quebec, which I eventually did visit at one point. But I traveled all over the world working in organics. I've seen organics in probably 12 different countries. I moved to Japan in 1988. Just to get some overseas experience, and ended up founding a certification company with my business partner, Griffith McClellan, in 1996. Organics in Japan in 96 and the 90s was really a dream in a few people's eyes. We were looking overseas and saying, oh, organic. It wasn't part of the government story. It wasn't part of really, retailers weren't interested too much. And then all of a sudden there was this Apple scare in California and Oregon and Washington called the Alar Apple scare. So there was this chemical called Alar, and everybody all of a sudden rushed to buy organic apples. And so all of a sudden there weren't any more organic apples because no one could imagine that people would buy them all up. And that was really the kind of the genesis of the Japanese kind of interest in imported organic foods. And all of these big import companies jumped on the bandwagon and started importing apple juice, mainly for babies, for baby food, and apple puree and things like that. So that's kind of when people started to realize what organic was in Japan. And since that time, it's incredible. I mean, I know you're in the Netherlands now, and you're seeing, you know, the EU push for 25% surface area certified organic by 2030. But actually in Japan, they're doing the same thing. It's slightly different. It's 25% organically managed land by 2030, but not specifically certified. So that's a bit of a twist. But if you would have told me in 1996 when I started the Organic Certifier with Griffith McClellan, QAI Japan, I would have told you you're crazy, because who could imagine that governments, that particularly the Japanese government, being as conservative as it is, would actually get behind organics? It's incredible.
Yeah, it's quite interesting because at least when I grew up, we used to watch a lot of movies, especially from Japan, and I could always look at the scenery around it. I mean, it was all natural. Everything was sort of organic, you might say. When you also looked at the people, they sort of liked this rural and scenic nature kind of lifestyle. So I don't know, from your experience, was this something maybe you could say it's different when you look from the Western world and you compare from the Eastern world, for example, when you're in Japan? Is this something that you might attribute maybe made them be early adopters of organic in one way or another?
Well, I mean, you have to remember Japan is a very old civilization, right? And, you know, in all the developed and undeveloped countries around the world, there wasn't anything that wasn't organic before, say, 1930 or so, right? So a lot of the scenery that you see isn't necessarily managed organically, but the technology has always been there, right? Because it's ancient technology. So essentially, you know, when we're talking about organics, people think, oh, we're going to go back to the 20s, or we're going to go back to the 1910s or whenever. But actually, you're taking a certain approach about the ecosystem of that particular property. And Japan is really good at planning and long-term thinking. Tokyo is, I think, still the largest city in the world. I was living in Tokyo, in Kawasaki, which is right next to Tokyo, for almost the whole time I was in Japan. So yeah, I didn't have the image of countryside at all, right? Yeah. Countryside in Japan is, you go to the countryside, if you go to a mountain and want to take a hike, you basically wait in line to climb up to the top, right? So it's a crowded place, and there are a lot of people, and you just kind of forget how many people you are. And if you go in the countryside, you get on a crowded train, you go to the countryside, and you get off, and yes, there might be some rice paddies, and it might be very beautiful. And, you know, Mount Fuji, the region around Mount Fuji is fantastic. And that's not very far from Tokyo, actually. It's about an hour and a half by train outside of Tokyo. So yes, you're very accessible to the countryside, but practically you don't spend a lot of time in the countryside when you're living in Tokyo.
Yeah, I think now that makes sense, because I think in every country you're bound to have those moments. I mean, the people who are in the city, and then there are people who are in the rural areas, so it sort of kind of disconnected, but you can always make time to, you know, check out what's going on the other side. The other interesting point that I noticed, I mean, when you moved from Japan to New Zealand, I mean, when I look at the organic sector, in especially from the oceanic perspective, I mean, you have Australia, New Zealand, Samoa, Fiji, all those countries. I was looking at the latest statistics by IFOM. Actually, oceanic has about a half of the world organic land, which is organic. It's interesting, but most of it is about 99% of it is in Australia. But maybe now you can let us know, in New Zealand, how is the organic movement, especially from a policy perspective and a market perspective? What is the state of organic in New Zealand right now?
So one of the interesting things about moving to New Zealand from Japan for me was the fact that, you know, Japan is this manufacturing powerhouse, right? And essentially it imports tons of food and tons of raw materials, and it exports automobiles and computers and semiconductors and high-end televisions and all these things. New Zealand is exactly the opposite of that. New Zealand is a very rural. The three things that support New Zealand economy are education, you know, students coming in to study in a beautiful place, scenery. So we've got a beautiful country. It's one of the most beautiful places you'd ever want to visit. And so tourism. And then the third is agriculture. And I suppose you could throw in forestry, but people kind of lump forestry and agriculture together as primary industries. So it may be meaning that you gather things from the ground, right? So most of the people are engaged in agriculture, whereas in Japan, you know, it's like 5% of the people are engaged in agriculture. So here, you know, everything is about agriculture and exports. So the food that we produce is exported. The market in New Zealand is quite a bit different than the market in Australia, for a couple of reasons. Mainly, we're focused on, I think, dairy production predominantly, but then of course, beef and lamb production. The areas that organics has traditionally been strong in is not those areas. They're horticulture areas, so grape production for winemaking or kiwi fruit, which you may be familiar with, and apples, which we call pip fruit here. BioGrow certifies almost all of the apples and all the kiwi fruit and about 50% of the dairy production and another 50% of all the other livestock production. Of course, honey is big here. Organic honey production is massive and a growing sector for us. But the organic sector here is growing at about 6.5% a year, and there is very little government support. We are unregulated. In fact, I met with officials from MPI yesterday, the Ministry for Primary Industries yesterday, and got an update on the status of the organic bill, which is now in Parliament and waiting for its second reading. And also we're working on the regulations and the standards for organics. So right now, our customers can export to the EU or the US or Japan and other places like Switzerland and where else? Oh, the UK, of course, through the government, a government export only program. Oh. But the domestic market isn't regulated. So, and the same is for for Australia. So Australia also is unregulated except for exports. Exports are regulated. And this is a peculiarity, I think, in Oceania, that they don't want government regulation over primary industries as a kind of rule. And I think it probably has served them very well, because that way they can be very nimble and essentially they're responding to overseas regulations. So essentially they produce to the overseas regulation rather than having their own regulation, which then they need to negotiate. So it's a really kind of fail fast way of looking at things in a certain way.
That certainly looks interesting, but from the look of things, it looks like you are definitely very soon going to have your regulation in place. I mean, right now it looks like it's in Parliament already. So it's in just a couple of years. You should be...
That's right.
Yeah, you should be able to get all that support from the government.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think we're on the right track, and it's an exciting time for organics here in New Zealand and Japan. Yeah. And of course, the US. Last year sold $9 billion worth of produce. So if you're getting into produce, the US is your market. It's hard to believe that's the number, right? That's about 15 or 16% of the total value of all produce in the United States. So that's pretty, it's no longer a niche. It is definitely mainstream.
Yeah, yeah. You mentioned a little bit earlier, I mean, you are the CEO of BioGrow, which is one of the largest certifiers of organic in New Zealand. I mean, we all know part of why organic is doing well is because of the trust that, you know, consumers have towards organic products. I mean, there is that third-party guarantee that whatever you're buying in the supermarket or in your grocery store is organic because someone else, other than the farmer himself, is telling you, you know what, this product is actually organic. So I'm just wondering, from your experience of dealing with farmers, why do you think most farmers want to, you know, be organic certified? I mean, there's that perspective of course, making money from it. But I have a gut feeling that it's more than that. Is there anything that you've spotted from that perspective?
Oh, definitely. I think that the majority of organic producers, whether they be, you know, livestock or horticulture or cropping, are in it because they value their land and themselves. So organics, you don't use a lot of chemicals, and you're not using soluble fertilizers, and it's actually a lifestyle choice for most producers that they don't want to use those chemicals. Some of them become very successful. I think you have to be an exceptional business person to be an organic producer, because you're dealing with a lot more regulation and you need to be very fast. You need to be kind of pioneering, forward thinking. At least he did 20 years ago. These days, I think there tends to be more of the money making coming into it, and that's just, I think, part and parcel of the sector getting bigger, or the industry getting bigger, depending on how you talk about it. But really, you know, organic farms, if you go on an organic farm, you know straight away it's an organic farm. It looks different. Yeah. There are a lot more weeds. There's a lot different kind of look to it. It isn't as clean or pristine as you might expect the farm to be. But actually, what that means is that the farmer, he or she has got their production system going in a way that's, I wouldn't say in harmony, because nothing is ever in harmony, right? It's always, you know, you're always at the whim of weather with agriculture, right? You've got either got too much rain, or you don't have enough rain, or you got too much wind, or not enough wind, or you got too cold or too hot. And it's always like that, whether you're organic or not. But I think all farmers, whether organic or not, take a lot of pride in what they do. Organic farmers, I think, have just been fortunate to be exposed to the information and the tool set that they need to go organic. And I think actually more farmers would become organic if they had the support systems that allowed them to take that leap, because actually it's a massive shift in thinking, and they really need someone to help them with that shift. And one of the things is that often farmers expect the certification companies to be the ones to guide them through that. And so that's kind of a catch-22 for us, because as a third-party certifier, we are actually representing the consumer. So the third party is actually saying, hey, on behalf of the consumer, I'm going to make sure that this guy is doing what the standards say he or she should do. So they are practicing the organic standards the way they're intended to be practiced, right? So yeah. That's our role. So we can't actually tell them then how to practice, you see. Yeah. But the producer comes to us and they want certification, but they also want a bit of advice. You know, what should I do? What happens if I have leaf rollers? What happens if I need a bit of kickstart in the spring on the bud burst? What do I need to do? Yeah. And we can't tell them that. We can point to a list of approved materials, yeah. But we can't actually say this is what you got to do.
Talking about you know, support and business, you have your latest book that is out now, which is Organic to the Core, where
got right here.
Exactly. Organic to the Core, where you share six organic principles that businesses can use to transform their business. So I'm wondering, what was the motivation behind writing this book?
So, you know, I've been, this year is 30 years in organics for me, and it's my, you know, it's my life's work. I'm really proud of the people that I've been able to meet, and the people I've been able to work with, and the customers that I've been able to serve over the years. And I've learned a lot from all of these people. And so what I think is there's a lot that the organic producers and organic people can teach other business people. So we talk about, you know, the 17 sustainable development goals, or we talk about ESG investing. And a lot of these are just basic principles that are embedded in organics. You know, treat people well, you treat animals well, you treat the property well, yeah. You treat your community well. And so in the book, I just talk about these principles, but from a business point of view. So it's written for a business owner, or say a business team manager, and they could then take those principles. And it's basically, you mentioned earlier about trust. How do you build a system that allows customers to trust you, or that allows people to trust you? And a lot of that just has to do with, you know, following the basic laws that we have around the world, you know, your basic labor laws. If you follow those, you're pretty far along. Mm. If you follow, you know, diversity and inclusion best practices, you're very far along. If you follow, you know, basic, you know, environmental protection laws, you're pretty far along. And a lot of businesses, they look at these laws as hurdles to overcome. But in fact, if you flip that around and say, these aren't hurdles, these are guidelines that we need to stay within, then actually you can use them to your advantage, because what people really want today is products that they can trust. And organic products are products that you can trust. And so what I've done is try and distill these concepts into a book. And boy, it was really hard.
I'm assuming it's never easy. I mean, I've been involved in some writing before, and one thing for sure is that it's not easy unless you have a very high motivation on why you really, really want to do it. That's the only way that you can go ahead and do it. In the book, actually, you shared six principles that businesses can use. And the first principle that you mentioned is about people. And it was very interesting for me that the first thing that you actually say is that as a business, you should start with people, and you advise not to define a role and find people, but the other way around. I mean, this might sound a little bit, you know, contrary to the beliefs. I mean, most businesses is, hey, I want an accountant, so you go out and find the person. I want a receptionist, you go out and find this person. But you advise the opposite. So can you sort of elaborate why you think that is important, that business should maybe take that path?
Well, I think if you treat people like people instead of treating people like a tool, you get a different approach, right? And you get a different response. So if you hire someone because of who they are, you know, their education or their attitude or, you know, their experience, they're going to bring that whole self to your business, and they're not going to stop at the edge of the role. But if you hire someone to do just the accounting, but someone who is an accountant who is also, say, a rock climber, right? A rock climber is going to look at that mountain, they're going to see a way up. But then they'll see another way up as they get further up, right? Same thing with accounting. You can do accounting a dozen different ways. If you do accounting just to account for what's happening, you never succeed. What you want is an accountant who's actually going to be able to say, hey, this is your cash flow for the next six months. And these are the customers that are not paying well. And these are the customers that we should actually be raising the rates for. So then if you're hiring for the person, you're going to get quite a bit more out of them. That's the reason behind that.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting way to look at it, because I mean, where we are right now, everything is sort of specialized. So you are, you know, supposed to come into a company, your roles are very, very, very much defined, and you know what you are meant to come and do is just fit into that box, and that is what you're expecting to do, and you know, go on and do your thing. But you know, as human beings, we have different interests, we have different things that we need to do, so it sort of makes sense you know, to follow that model and give people a room to be creative and, you know, to think outside the box and try to see, what can I do? Yes, I'm you know, I've been scheduled to do this particular task, but what can I do in terms of creativity to bring on different ideas, which I think a lot of businesses can do with, in terms of coming up with different and new ideas in the process. So that's an interesting perspective that a lot of business should be able to consider, actually, I think, moving forward. On the book, as I mentioned, you shared six principles. You know, quality is there, business, communication. You talk about community. You talk about doing good and, you know, taking care of the environment. And, you know, this last point might sound obvious because right now we see a lot of business talking about, you know, we want to take care of the environment. Governments are also coming in, giving incentives for businesses, either through subsidies or tax credits, to try, you know, and encourage them to take care of the environment. What was your perspective in writing that part?
So I kind of see community and the environment as interrelated. So if you've got a business, well, these days, you know, we have distributed businesses because everybody's working at home, but generally, you know, at some place you've got an address on your masthead, right? You've got the address, and you've got a place where people go to work. That might be a factory, that might be an office, it might be a place where you do certification. That place is within a wider community. And, you know, you've got roads, you've got trains, you've got buses, all those things are part of the community. You've got schools. And then every person in the company has a family. And whether that's themselves or their parents or, you know, their partner or their wife or husband, their children, their pets, you know, they've got family. So, you know, when we think about a business, we can't just think about that individual, but also their family and then the community that supports them. Right. If you got moms and dads, they get to get their kids to school in the morning. And if something happens at school, well, then they have to go pick them up. So supporting that school, if you can, then that makes people feel better about who they are and the connection. And so there are a lot of businesses around the world who support a local school or local a group of local schools, or, you know, there might be businesses that support you know, a religious organization, or even just paying their taxes, in fact, right?
Yeah.
You know, being honest, paying their taxes and paying the tax that they should be paying, not bragging about, you know, well, we didn't have to pay any taxes because actually we don't have any business there. But is that really supporting the community where your customers live? Mm. And I think there's a lot of people who aren't very happy about large businesses who benefit from tax reduction schemes, because then we end up paying the difference, right? So, you know, it isn't all about the lowest possible price, right? It isn't all about the highest profit margin.
Yeah.
We need to think that, you know, if you think about the price of anything right now, today, for the most part, there's no environmental cost built into that price. I've always said that accounting is really the thing that's going to revolutionize the way we think. And responsibility at the board level or the shareholder level for environmental impact is I think the way that's going to happen. So if we have responsibility at the board level or the shareholder level for the actions of the business, then of course they're going to account for those things.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, yes, the price of everything will go up, but you'll see then all of a sudden the organic stuff is going to be really cheap because the cost won't increase for the most part. Some products and some production methods, even in organics, probably aren't as sustainable as others. But when you're talking about small landholders or family-owned farms, for the majority, they're very environmentally friendly. And so those products won't go up in cost, whereas you might see a massive monoculture and they'll have to pay for water use, or they'll have to pay for fertilizer runoff, cleanup, or they'll have to pay for some other kind of environmental pollution. And then all of a sudden that stuff won't be so cheap.
Yeah.
So they won't be able to produce that way anymore. But right now we don't have that. And that's because nobody's responsible.
Yeah,
and logically, the person to be responsible for it is the board member who represents the shareholder.
True. I think there's a lot of responsibilities that need to be taken care of. Unfortunately, that's we see that a lot. There are not a lot of businesses who are ready to be responsible or even be held responsible for some of the things that they are doing. I mean, example, we see Monsanto's can produce, you know, toxic chemicals and then throw them into the environment and have no repercussions for it, you know. And I think when moving forward in terms of from an environmental perspective, we have to be, you know, hold these companies responsible for, you know, some of their products that are given into the market. So I think that's also a very good point, that as business move forward, they see how they can work with the community and also see how they can put the environment at the core of what they are doing. Right now, we have been dealing with COVID for about 2 years. How has this affected, you know, certification? Did you find it hard maybe to go to farms and, you know, try to check them if they are holding organic standards as much as possible? I mean, what has been your experience throughout this time?
So even before COVID, we had developed a system to do remote audits, mainly for surveillance audits. So in organics, we've got three different kinds of audits. We've got the annual audit, where there's a, you know, a few 31st of January is your expiry date on your certificate. So you're going to have an annual audit every January to make sure that that meets. Then you also, if there's some major nonconformance, or if you have parallel production, you'll have what's called a surveillance audit during harvest. And then that looks at, you know, how you're keeping the non-organic and organic products separate. Usually it's a different variety of the same product, but sometimes it's just completely different parallel production. And then the third is unannounced audits. So the unannounced audits are what we were trying to do with remote. And unannounced audits, basically you just show up on the day, or maybe you ring them, say, hey, you're going to be around tomorrow? I might pop by. And you might even just drive by the property. I might drive up the driveway and have a look, see how things look. Is it looking too clean? You know, is who's around, who's on the property, are they doing anything? And that's a surveillance audit. It might also be, it might be soil sampling. If a neighbor says, hey, that guy over there looks like he's using something. So we might go out and do some sampling, either tissue sampling or soil sampling, depending on what the complaint is. Because usually you get the neighbor saying, oh, that guy, he's using the same thing I'm using and I'm not organic.
Yeah.
So every once in a while you'll get that. Not in New Zealand very often, but in other countries where I've worked, we've had that before. And so this remote audit system we'd already had. So our government, Ministry for Primary Industries, during the first lockdown, we had daily meetings for a week, and then we had weekly meetings to set up this remote audit system. And then they put an online training. We trained all of our auditors in what the government wanted to be done during this remote audit. And then we did those for 2 months. Then here in New Zealand, we've been really fortunate because we've had very few cases and very few deaths, actually, you knock on wood. So we were about three months total between 2020 and 2021 when we couldn't do on-site audits. Yeah. And now it's coming back. We've got Omicron now back in the community. So we're going to be doing more remote audits. But the thing is, with remote audits, you can only do it on existing customers. So if it's a new customer, you don't have a track record, so you can't use that. And you can only do it once. So you have to do an off-site. You'd have to do an on-site or a face-to-face audit at some point. So yeah, it is a bit tricky that way.
I was wondering, and in terms of looking, for example, we see IFOM is working very hard in terms of pushing for PGS, so participatory guarantee system. Is this something that you're also looking at? And there's been also a lot of talk about blockchain and how can organic utilize that kind of things in the certification. So I was wondering what is your perspective on those two things, actually?
Well, I always like to tell people that, you know, blockchain doesn't change anything, because how do you know what's written in the blockchain is true? So it's fair to say that in a financial transaction, you're pretty sure that you have the value there that's written. But when you're writing, hey, I sold this many cabbages, or I sold this many onions, nobody knows if he actually did or not. That information isn't verified. So the blockchain to me is not really ready for any major disruption as far as agriculture goes. I think there are other systems that do the same thing anyway. I mean, the old-fashioned transaction certificate, if it's issued by a third-party verifier, that has validity to write in the blockchain. But it isn't practical if it can't be automated. And if you automate something, then it can be hacked. So we actually have PGS here in New Zealand. We have had for about 20 years. It's called Organic Farm New Zealand. They run kind of a hybrid PGS audit scheme for basically market gardeners. Biogro doesn't have a PGS scheme. We've run group certification schemes in, I think, Solomon Islands for coconut production. PGS is only as good as the members. The way the PGS works is, if you've got a pod of, say, four or five growers and they live in the same region, I think it's really great to have a PGS scheme as far as supporting each other and learning from each other. To a certain extent, keeping tabs on each other. As a verification scheme, I think there's some obvious flaws in it, because if one person decides that they're going to do something that's against the standards, then all of them fall over. So there's quite a bit of risk for the other members of that. And as those groups get bigger and bigger, the risk increases. So if you've got 25 people in a group, the way PGSs usually work is the group is certified, not the individuals in the group. So if the group falls over, Because essentially they're supposed to police each other. They're supposed to audit each other. They're supposed to record everything. And, you know, auditing is a skill in and of itself, right? Auditing is essentially being able to tell somebody no without saying no, being able to ask a question without actually asking a question, and being able to get somebody to tell you information that they don't want to tell you, right? So you ask the question like, hey, I noticed that you're wearing a white shirt. And then you stop. And then they tell you, oh, yeah. I got this from my brother-in-law. And you say, oh, really? Did you know you're not supposed to be wearing a white shirt? Mm. Your uniform is supposed to be green. And then they're like, oh, that's right. So, you know, auditing is something of a, you know, you never ask, did you do this, right? That you can't ask a yes or no question. So I think peer-to-peer has its place, but I don't think it replaces an annual audit. But that said, I think there's a lot to be done with remote sensing and remote verification and data exchange. Personally, I think that we go away from an annual audit to more documentation exchange more frequently. So purchase records and production records and sale records don't need to be done on site. That should all be remote access. And then, you know, photographs or even video, and dare I say, video monitoring of harvest. I think video monitoring, remote video monitoring is a norm in police work, in quality work. I don't see why you couldn't have a camera or ask someone to turn on their phone and walk around and show you what's going as far as surveillance. So I think that it's just how far do you want compliance to go to verify what you're doing, right? I think there's definitely going to be a convergence between food safety, organics, and social verification. So fair trade, essentially fair trade. So I think, and you'll see in the next 10 years or so, organic and fair trade will disappear. I think that those will be superseded by regulation that incorporates those into them. So you'll see the regular food safety incorporate organic into it.
Very, very interesting predictions there. Looking forward to them also as well. But thank you very much for, you know, sharing your insights and your experiences over the years that you have encountered through the organic movement across different continents. So I want us to quickly move to the rapid fire question. So this is a segment that I've prepared like 10 questions for you. So I get to throw them to you, and then you will provide me with the answers for the questions, essentially. So are you ready to get started?
Yes.
Good. So the first question is, what was the first career you dreamt of having as a kid?
Scientist.
If you had to eat one meal going forward, what would you eat?
Cheese.
Okay. Who is your favorite historical figure?
Benjamin Franklin.
Okay. The fourth question, what sport do you like to watch or participate in?
I love to watch American football.
Makes sense. The fifth question, if you could have any animal in the world as a pet, what will it be and why?
So I had parakeets. Oh, my mom had parakeets when we were growing up. So I really like parakeets. I'd like to have a parakeet.
Sixth question, what's your favorite beverage? Is it coffee or tea?
Coffee, definitely coffee.
What is your favorite book?
My favorite book is The Sand Colony Almanac by Aldo Leopold. So Aldo Leopold is one of the pioneers of sustainability in Wisconsin and ecological management. And Sand Colony Almanac was one of the books that influenced me to get involved in organics.
The eighth question, are you an early bird or a night owl?
Well, that's the thing, you know, I wake up early and I stay up late, so I don't know what I am.
Okay, so fair to say sleep is not your friend?
I'm an early bird, I guess.
Ah, okay, interesting. The ninth question, what quote resonates with you most?
My favorite quote is from a movie, actually. And I don't know if this is the exact quote, but the quote goes, it all works out in the end. If it's not working out, it's not the end. I love that quote. I live by that.
Yeah, it definitely makes sense, I think. So the last question is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give to your 18-year-old self?
I think I would tell my 18-year-old self to take care of your health. That's the most important thing. Yeah.
Nice. Thank you very much for taking part in the rapid fire question. So this is a segment that I think a lot of the audience get to appreciate and get to know more a little bit more about the guests. So thank you very much for participating in it. And overall, your latest book, Organic to the Core, is out. So the audience can find it on Amazon, right?
That's right. Just search Organic to the Core and it pops right up.
Yeah, Organic to the Core. And I think I will link it in the description so that people can get a hold on it and use those six principles to transform their business moving forward. So a great thank you very much for joining me in the podcast. I know we are in very different time zones, but somehow we made this one work. Yeah, looking forward to potentially meeting you in person one way or another, so in the future.
Oh, that'd be fantastic. Yeah.
So thank you very much for joining me in the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me to be a guest.
Anywhere where the audience can follow you on social media?
Yes, so on Twitter, I'm Donald Nording, and LinkedIn, same thing. So just LinkedIn and Twitter, you can find me.